Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Red Light Podcast Redux. I am your host, Gina Savage. Today I'm joined with, I'm going to get right into it, but I just want to say our guest today weathered a snowstorm. And then, you know, you came from Connecticut?
Yes.
Connecticut through it was a blizzard. And then, no, it really wasn't. But now it's like 80.
Yeah, but randomly out there, you feel like you're in Alaska because there's so much snow coming down and there's so much sticking to the ground. And it feels like the wild frontier. My kids were sent home from school early. Then you get into the city, you don't see a snowflake.
Yeah, it's crazy. But let me tell the folks about you. And first, I want to thank our WROM radio listeners in Detroit, internet users worldwide, those of you who subscribe on iTunes to the Red Light Podcast Redux. All right, I'm going to tell you about our guest. First of all, from a blog that I found called Everyone's Talking.
Oh.
You describe yourself as a passionate, enthusiastic person who has no shortage of things to say. Thank God, because I have a shortage of things to say.
That's funny. I forgot about that.
Yeah,
you do your research.
I pull up one thing, but it says a lot. But you're a stand-up. You have appeared at clubs, colleges throughout the country. You are also a writer, producer, exec producer who served on such shows as, and I will repeat them, I'm not repeating them, I'm saying them for the first time, the Kenan Ivory Wayans Show, Montel, Bethany, Comedy Nation with John Fugelsang, to name a few. So ladies and gentlemen, our guest today, Barry Leese.
Yay, I'm happy to be here. Hi.
Hey.
I love that the room's actually red.
It is red.
I heard someone else say that. Is that why you named the show The Red Light?
Well, thank you for asking.
Yeah.
I have it's actually called The Red Light because of the red light that comedians get to get off the stage.
So
So we know when to wrap it up here at the
gotcha.
Red light. It's an hour. That's, you know, most people don't have an attention span that goes, you know, past 20 minutes, to be perfectly honest.
Right.
I think 10 minutes people are like out the door.
That
you
makes
know,
sense.
Like, you know, and you know when you're watching a comedy tape, how many minutes, well, you're in the business on both sides of this business.
Right.
So how long does it take you to watch somebody's tape or tape, like they're linked now?
Right. When I was actually casting comics or picking comics, yeah, you kind of
Three
to 5 minutes in,
you're
you
out.
Get a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get a sense.
So let's tell the folks a little bit about you in less than 3 to 5. And let's tell them about you because I know you through our good friend Marla Schultz. And everything that I just read off this list is everything that, you know, if you're in this business, this is a lot of work. This is a body of work. It didn't come out of nowhere. So tell us about yourself a little bit.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
Let's see. So you said how I came to be, you were saying.
Well, where'd you grow up?
Brooklyn.
Okay.
Until I was 10.
Okay. Only child?
Or no.
How many?
Middle child.
Okay. See, I like to.
Jan Brady.
Hi, Jan. I was the baby.
Oh, that's a good spot.
You really,
no? It also depends on the level of parenting and dysfunctional parenting, right?
Like right.
Which spot is the best?
Sure.
But, middle child. I had an older brother and a younger sister. And my mother died when I was young, when I was 3.
Oh, wow.
So I was raised by a single dad. So that was a little different, you know.
Sure.
Especially back then. You know, now you see more of that. There's so much divorce and there's many like single parents raising kids and single dads. But back then it was kind of almost an anomaly. I met one other person when I was 11 who was a girl whose mother had died and the father was raising the kids. So,
and what did he do for a living?
Well, he had been a teacher before he met my mom, a Spanish teacher. Then when he married my mom, her father was involved. He was a New York City marshal, and it's a political appointment as well as it is like, you know, you have a gun and a badge and all that.
Right.
And he got my father a job doing that because he wanted them to live in Brooklyn and be close. So my dad went from being a Spanish teacher, which he loved, and kind of not a gun-carrying guy.
Right.
To like somebody who was evicting people for not paying their bills and going to the worst neighborhoods in Brooklyn, like you know the Father Pan. Well, no, that's Bridgeport, but like the worst neighborhoods, Bensonhurst, and that's not a bad neighborhood. What am I talking about?
You have
to edit this.
Not like,
Bensonhurst, Bushwick, like just these really.
No, I lived in Bensonhurst. It's not. Yeah, right.
But
so
that,
yeah.
He, yeah, and then that was not really his thing, but he was doing it to like please his in-laws so that my mother and him could live closer to them. Anyway, so, and there's funny stories from that. Like, he would say how, like he would go to evict someone and they would, you can cut this out, but like they would say, oh, the marshal's raping me. And they would start like pulling off their clothes and claim like the marshal's raping me, the marshal, you know, just like.
Well, in these times, I maybe want to keep this in because, you know, there's so many people, that, you know, claiming, you know, that they're being raped. You know.
Yeah, they would claim, you know.
So how did he deal with that?
Get out of the fact that like they weren't paying their bills and whatever. Well, eventually what would happen is he and the other marshals would have police escort with them.
Right.
And Con Edison, which sounds strange, it was the electric company in Brooklyn and in New York, but they would have Con Edison guys that went with them on the evictions so that they had witnesses, you know, yes. That they weren't trying to hurt anybody. They were just, right. You haven't paid your bills and now you're evicted.
Sure.
And they're hired to do that. So it's not, you know, it's certainly not like a glamorous or,
yeah.
No one's happy to see the marshal show up at the door, right?
No, believe me, I can relate to that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was till I was 10. And then my mom died. I was 3. My sister was 2. My brother was 6. And my dad was raising us alone. With some help from my grandparents. And then he felt like, I'm a widower with 3 kids. He liked to say that over and over. Like, this job's too dangerous. I shouldn't be, like, on the line like that with people that are pulling guns and knives on me and stuff like that. So he moved us to Connecticut when I was 10.
Okay, so you're 10 in Connecticut.
10 in Connecticut. My dad's brother lived there. So now we were in a very, my ex-boyfriend used to call it Mayberry when he came to see where
it
was.
So
he
went all the way from
Connecticut.
Right.
Yeah, like Mayberry, like with a gazebo in the middle of the town and very white and very either Catholic or Protestant, very few Jews, which were Jewish, not that we're religious, but you know what I mean? I used to say like when I first started doing stand-up, you know, you have all those like bad beginning jokes that are like not that original, but you remember them from like your first original sets.
Sure.
I remember saying like, you know, I grew up in Fairfield, Connecticut, and I was the most ethnic person in Fairfield, you know, just because I have dark
brown hair.
Brown hair.
It's amazing. I feel like that in certain parts of Florida. Like, you know, everybody's blonde or like,
yes.
You know, dyed or it's like
it's
white
usually
hair.
Dyed for sure. But like, it's really weird when yeah. You realize you're the most ethnic person just because you have dark hair,
yeah.
Right? Like,
we're all shared of these people.
Yeah, there's a little more, you know,
gypsies, tramps, and Gina.
Yeah, so when I look back at pictures, even now, and I'm still friends with some of my friends from junior high and high school, I'm always the only brunette in the picture. They're all blonde, which is just funny.
All right, so let me,
anyway.
All right, I want to move you along.
Move us along.
I want to move you along because, all right, so now we get a sense of, you know, your lifestyle. Now you've got some conditions growing up in Connecticut.
Mm.
You're a good student, I take it.
I was a good student, yeah.
And you didn't want to cause any trouble.
How'd you know that? You know me.
You don't want to have any problems with Dad. He's got enough on his hands.
Right.
So when do you decide to do stand-up? And when I know at some point you go into broadcast journalism, so
mm-hmm.
Try to marry those two things
okay.
for me.
So I should say that like within that childhood, you know, I think you talked about this, like being kind of latchkey, right?
Yeah, a little
bit.
You
know, back then. So you're by yourself, your one parent is working. So my sort of, I don't want to say escape, but I think like what I did mostly was watch television at home and listen to music and sing along with the music and like eventually knew the words to like every single song, you know?
Sure.
And sort of nobody's really asking you ever like, hey, how you doing? Like, how do you feel? How's it going? You know, so like the only...
You're in your own room world.
Yeah, so the only time you're like expressing any emotions is through the songs that you're singing. It's like...
Sure. Who did you pick for these?
Oh, everybody. I mean, from like Elvis, you know, 8 tracks.
I'm caught in a trap.
Yeah, that my dad was getting from the Columbia, you know, the 8-track
yeah,
club.
Yeah, the 8-track.
The 8-track club, baby. That's what,
yeah.
So I learned some music from there. You know, Neil Sedaka.
Oh, yeah.
Not you know, the hippest 70s stuff, but that. And then later, you know, my brother introduced me to all the really good stuff, like rock and roll, Beatles, Rolling Stones, stuff like that. But so I think back, I think, like, the only time I expressed emotion was singing along with these songs.
Sure.
And, like, relating to the words.
Okay.
And, like, singing the songs over and over kind mm-hmm. of thing, you know. So, anyway, so, yeah, I was in the plays in school, whatever. But I don't think I thought about, like, doing any of that stuff for a living. And I went to college. I went to Miami for college, and I was a political science major, and my plan going to college was like, I'm going to go to college, go to law school, become a lawyer. I thought I wanted to like work in Washington and all that kind of stuff.
Which is an exciting, you know, lifestyle choice.
I guess, you know, I thought like,
you know, politics.
I was all into that. Like when I was, you know, I was such an idealist when I was younger. I really thought that.
Is that Jimmy Carter time?
Yeah, it was Jimmy Carter, and then I guess Ronald Reagan.
You're right in there.
But I was an idealist. I still have these idealist things about me, but too much so for someone of my age who's lived this many decades.
No, you can't lose that.
Yeah, but for real, like it shouldn't still be there because it's like hasn't life knocked it out of you enough yet. Like it certainly has. But
right,
then,
right.
You know, I don't know why or where, but
I don't either. I don't know.
Because
hope.
I was gonna say hope because it's the same with the journalism. Like once I got into when I first got into journalism and I worked a few years in it, I really believed in like because there is journalism
Absolutely.
That has changed the world and
yes.
has, you know, helped people and broke. Even just like that movie Spotlight, you know, it was mm-hmm. the journalists who brought that story to
Absolutely.
Light. I firmly believed that's what journalism was. And when I started out, there was more of that, too.
Right.
It's
bubblegum. There's a lot of bullshit.
Now it's just like when I hear kids saying they're going to study journalism, I think, what are they even teaching them? Like, are they teaching them how to write a blog with no facts and no, you know, there's no fact checking even at.
Right.
That's a wrong statement. I was going to say at CNN, but I should say there's often stories that appear to have had no fact checking, even on, you know, major networks. It's, you know, anyway, but so like the idealism. But anyway, I went to college and the first year I started working I took a communications class and I realized like, oh, I really like this. And I started interning at WTVJ in Miami, which was a NBC O&O, like, owned and operated station.
Sure.
And I decided I'll do a double major, poli-sci and broadcast journalism.
All right. And you took to that because, I mean, your career kind of, all right. Mm-hmm. So where does comedy come?
I should say about the comedy.
Right. Because it's all sort of at the same time.
Yeah. And it's funny because like, I didn't think I got into comedy until I came to New York, but all my Miami like friends and roommates reminded me that I kept saying I wanted to do it then. And I did do it during college, like at, you know, campus events and like off campus a little bit here and there, tried it out. Like one of my roommates reminded me, she said years ago when she said, you know, you always wanted to do that. Like before I remembered that I had, you know?
So you did it in Miami.
I did. And just a little, you know, like, you know, open mic kind of stuff. And I mean, you'd get booked on shows, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like in the system in the working your way up to feature headliner. No, it was just trying it out. But I think, when I said I was watching TV a lot as a kid, I watched a lot of comedy and I listened to every George Carlin. And, you know, that was a release from just kind of, like I say, not really expressing emotions or having anyone to really, you know.
Sure.
So
do you remember, can I take you back to this place? Because you listened to Carlin, mm-hmm. right? Do you remember that Carlin album where he was the DJ?
Yes.
And he's like, bing bong, it's 5 minutes past the big hour of 5 o'clock.
Right. And, it was very WKRP.
Yeah. Once in a while, I sing the song from that. And for those of you Carlin fans, he would sing this song. He's got, I'm going to do it because I loved it so much as a kid. Mm. I got one last pimple from going steady with you. Don't know whether to break it or leave it alone. It's the only one that I call my own.
I love that you know it all.
Yeah, I was six. Thank you.
That's
comedy.
Awesome.
All right.
Yeah.
So you're listening
like
to Carlin.
You're listening. Yeah. You're listening. And you're listening to the good stuff, too. Like, I feel like now, you know, there's so much comedy, right? Where would people, I mean, there's all these channels on Sirius and Pandora and everything.
Right.
But back then, nothing was getting out there that wasn't really good.
Right.
Like there was all crap was filtered out. I mean, there just wasn't even this abundance for there to be crap.
Well, even our parents' generation would see, this is the thing with generations,
right? Right.
Our parents' generations would say, this is crap. Our music was crap. Now we're saying this, you know, as we age, we're saying this is crap. I mean, it's all crap.
Maybe. I guess I just feel like,
but
I don't
it's
know,
not
I
the Edward R. Murrow days, you know? It's like when
journalism
and the network broadcasting these things, you know, like where you revered these people.
Yeah, right.
Revered them.
Right.
You know, now there are a few people on television. I mean, are there people on television just to get to this point?
Yeah, I was going to say that this might be something people have already tuned out. As you said, the 3 to 5 minutes. So let's
I don't think
stuff.
So. No. Well, I want to say, are there people that you respect on, like, are there broadcasters or journalists now that you like or have, you know? And even comics, John Fugel is to me, somebody out there.
Yeah, he's so smart and so quick. For what he does, doing like the political stuff, I mean, he has such an immense amount of knowledge about history and politics beyond, I think there's a lot of people that do political comedy and they're sort of one note, or they're like, they read the headlines. You know what I mean?
Sure.
John really can quote to you sort of the history of every...
He's
he's like an encyclopedia. And then, of course, he's very funny. So, but as far as, I think Diane Sawyer's really good.
Yes.
I've always thought she was really good. And I'm trying to think men-wise. I liked Brian Williams before everything that went down with Brian Williams.
Yeah.
I actually used to say I thought he was quite neutral. I thought he did a good job at staying neutral. When I worked at NBC News, it was Tom Brokaw. Nightly News with Tom Brokaw.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, certainly very well respected within the building and everything. And he was always, there was sort of, like an air about him of that old school,
Well, what was it like for you? Okay, so that's, I appreciate that. What was it like for you? You're a woman in this business. I don't know, what that was like for you. And I know I say like you're a woman in this business, but you're a woman in this business.
Right.
I have to stick up for myself in ways I can't even believe I still have to, stick up for myself, even in an email chain, really are we, that I have to, remind whatever the case may be, constantly sticking up. So how did you feel? And, mm-hmm. You worked your way through these things. You're doing stand up.
Mm-hmm.
When are you getting the first taste of like,
of feeling like
people get me? I'm being respected in this field. And what are you doing? What are you actually doing?
I'm not sure I ever got that feeling. I'm waiting for that feeling to come along. No, I think you have it at times. I don't think you have it continually when you're in and out of shows. Like, we're jumping ahead, but when I left news and got into talk, if you get on a talk show and it lasts 10 or 11 years, you're kind of golden. You're on that show for 10 or 11 years, unless you choose to go to the next one. But if you're on a show, I've launched a lot of shows that were one season shows. So then late night and daytime. So then you're out of work again, and then you have to find another job. So it doesn't ever take on, that feeling of like, oh, I've totally made it. You almost feel like you're back to square one, even though you've worked your way up to these like senior producing roles. When I first was at NBC, I was a page, and then you work on everything. You work on, it was Letterman back then, was at NBC. We worked on Letterman. You worked on Saturday Night Live. You were very much behind the curtain, with
sure.
all of it. And I worked on the Today Show Weekend Edition as a page. And once I got my first job, I still had to go back to answering phones at the Today Show for like $10 an hour, after having been a page and after having been an intern at CNN in New York and CNN in LA and WTNH in New Haven and WTVJ in Miami. Like, there's a lot of sort of now.
Right.
And so boys won't like that I'm saying this, right? But you asked me, when do you feel that difference? I will say this, that you see at the network level, certainly, and at the network level for sure, women come in. We had pages that were guys too, and there's interns that are guys too, but women had to do, I think, more low level roles for more years before they're being bumped up to associate producers and producers. So
unless
they're
a hot blonde and go right to fucking Fox or whatever.
They didn't even exist then. There wasn't even Fox, which, God, how old am I? But I did once work for Roger Ailes at America's Talking, which was like a little cable network that NBC had started. No, okay. No. But I have a funny story from that too. But anyway, I was going to say, because I was thinking about this. I was thinking about it that like I thought you were going to talk about that because I've heard you talk about it. And I think that the key difference was like a guy wouldn't have to be an assistant for a year and answer phones and then go back and be someone else's assistant and then go, Like, they're an intern and then they're a researcher. So they've bumped right up to researcher. They've skipped the level of like receptionist, answering phones, you know, it,
and this
assistant.
Is even with a degree and all of these things.
With
and
a degree,
still,
with
blah,
all
blah,
your
blah, blah,
internships
blah, blah.
And blah, blah, blah. So, you know, there definitely is that. And maybe, you know, on some level, and I'm not talking on the comic side, but I think this goes on both levels. Like, guys mentor other guys. Like, it's fun for the older guy to mentor the young guy. They see something in them that they reminds them of their youth, or I don't know what, but there's like a generosity with that that you would see, and you would not see that with women.
Because we're, you know, duking it out.
I've never had a mentor. I said to my friend the other day, who's a male TV executive, I was like, he was joking about something with me, saying maybe this is your big break, about a meeting with this female TV executive that had asked me to meet with her. And I said, wouldn't that be funny? Like, I'm getting my big break at, you know, this age, like, and I said to him, maybe she'll be my mentor. And we were joking because I said, I've never had a mentor, but you hear guys talk all the time. They had mentors, like people who took them along, and you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, all right. So you're having these, you know, successes in the, you know, and you're bouncing through the, you know, different media.
Yeah. On the upside, I would say, like, it was really fun and exciting to work on the Today Show. And, like, then I became Katie Couric's assistant at the Today Show. And, you know, that was, I was like, you know, maybe 23 years old. You know, that was fun to be sort of like living parallel. What, you know, what her day was my
day, right,
you
right.
know,
sure.
and at times that was my, there was a time where I thought I wanted to be a reporter and like an on air, you know, that's why I studied broadcasting
right.
And then I went to work at Dateline and it was a little more serious. But I'm still in touch with a lot of my coworkers from there and great
love
people.
That show. That's a great show.
Yeah. Great people and super smart, you know, which is one of the things that I really appreciated about working at Network News. And as you go through more syndicated shows and talk shows and you get out there, game shows, and you go to LA, there's so many production companies that you were talking before about who do you look up to and stuff. There is a different level of sort of, there was a different level of sort of grace and I don't really even know how to put it. It just seemed like everybody was really smart at the network, and
was there a certain ideal that they were setting, like that they were aspiring to with what they were doing? I mean, I would think so. There was certain like integrity about it.
Right, there was an integrity about it. There were certain morals about stories, right? And then you get out into the syndicated world, talk shows and whatever, and then you're like paying a little bit for a story, or maybe you're paying, you know, there's perks, you know, it's just so it's different. So Network News is like so clean because you're not, you know, people aren't getting something out of coming on there.
I want to talk about two things. First, I'm going to just joke it up a notch for this. So that
okay,
because I know the kids today, you know, this is the kind of news they like. Every time I'll even speak for myself. If you look at these videos and we see them on Facebook and whatnot, this is how they're getting their news. Like, they'll see a newscaster, and then like that newscaster will be hit in the face with like it'll be a weather girl.
Right.
She'll be hit in the face with a fish. She was the weather was so bad, the fish hit her, and she stumbles. Did you see the New Zealand guy? He's an official in New Zealand. He's, you know, talking about something, a protester. Threw a penis in his face, like a dildo.
God.
And that's hilarious. No, but that's how
but
we get our
funny,
news.
Right.
Like,
right.
So that's the news. But I want to go back to, hilarious. And I watch those. But anyway, you worked on the Keenan Ivory Wayans show. Mm.
Yeah.
What was that like?
So that was, you know, so after news in New York, and you said about how did you kind of do the comedy thing.
Right.
When I was working at Today Show, and particularly Dateline, it was very serious. We're working on very serious stories. And that was when I started going to the comedy clubs every night and really put more, you know, before that I had done here and there. But that was when I really felt like I need some comic relief. You know what I mean?
Right. Now, when you're, what are you actually doing on Dateline? Are you researching stuff?
Yes.
Researching the stories,
right, and setting up. Now the correspondents are going to go to whichever city to go do an interview, and sometimes you're field producing those interviews, so sometimes
you're out there.
Right, and sometimes because those stories can take 6 months to produce, like a long-term investigative story. I know it's hard to believe.
Amazing.
But you know, the long form, they call it, that's long form news, so there's many pieces to that. So it's like, we need to go to Cincinnati to get an interview with somebody, we need to go to LA and get an interview with this
one. At any given point, you could be working on a number of different stories. this while this is happening. Exactly. So you have the long-term story, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I like to know this just for my own edification, you know?
How it kind of works. And like, everybody there would have to keep a suitcase under their desk packed to go because could have to go at any time,
it's
exciting. It is exciting. that is exciting. And so in between, it is. And even if the story, even if the little piece of the interview that you're doing is not as like Dateline once sent me to Cincinnati, or was it Cleveland?
I saw that Cleveland. Story, though. I just
to interview John Demjanjuk, who was like rumored to be Ivan the Terrible, but he actually was Ivan the Terrible during the Holocaust, and he was a Nazi guard. And now he had years later been, you know, kind of exposed in Cleveland, Ohio, and he had been, I think, an auto worker for like 30 years or something. So he was getting extradited and coming back from trial, and I, with a camera crew, had to be at the airport and be like, John Demjanjuk, you know?
Oh, my God.
Are you Ivan the Terrible? You know, like...
With your sweet face. Yeah, well, that sweet face she's got.
I don't know how sweet, but, like, you know, I had a few questions I had to ask him and everything. Right. And it was, you know, that was going to be in the piece. So the piece always looks like it's the correspondent doing the whole thing.
Right.
But just like you see on broadcast news, you know, there's all these people behind that are going and getting some of the interviews. So you're just seeing the B-roll rolled into the... But that was very exciting to me, you know, that I'm getting to, you know, talk to this guy who, you know, potentially... And he was denying that he was a Nazi prison guard, but he was.
What ended up... I mean, you know, the story, you know, eludes me the whole story now at this point, but what ended up happening with him?
He was found to be, and I actually... I think I researched it sometime in the past 2 years and saw that while he was found to be, and he did have to, if I'm not mistaken, I almost want to Google it, that he did have to serve time in Europe.
Okay.
I could be wrong, though.
All right. We reserve the right to be wrong on this program.
Definitively. I know. I wish my phone wasn't dead because I'd Google it. But he was Ivan the Terrible, indeed.
Okay. So, We'll send Jim on that.
But, like, you know, when you're working at, like, Dateline or those network news shows, just before talking about Talk and Keenan, the exciting thing is, like, you're there, and then they go, oh, we got Jeffrey Dahmer. Stone Phillips is going to go interview Jeffrey Dahmer in jail, you know? And it's like you're at the center.
Love Stone Phillips.
I know.
God.
And he's such a nice guy, too. But you're at the center of just the biggest stories happening, especially at that time, because there wasn't 5 million cable channels, you know? So there was something exciting. At that time, I was still trying to, like, maybe be a local reporter and send tapes out to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and different places. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, you go, I think maybe I'd rather work my way up as a producer on these kind of stories because it's so exciting to be a part of, like, the national dialogue of, like, what's really going
on. Well, that's, again, tying in the comedy because you've got all this stuff going on. And you say, you even in this little blog that I read, you talk about being socially conscious and aware, and I think you have to be conscious in America now. Look at all the forget about America. Mm. Everywhere you have to be a aware person. There's so much going on,
right?
So you, as a comic, bring that perspective to whatever shows you do, whatever you're talking about. What were you talking about in the time frame that you're now? You're talking about Keenan. Let's go back to Keenan.
Yeah. Oh, so Keenan. So I will say that, like, the trajectory for me to go to that was that then I started doing daytime talk shows, and I was like, news producing at the Montel Williams show, which sounds strange, but they would also do news stories. And they sent me and this one production assistant, my buddy Dom, who I adore, and he now works at Channel 13. Shout out to Dominic. But they sent us to Oklahoma City, and we covered the bombing. You know, like 6 hours after the Oklahoma City bombing, we were out there. And just the two of us. And we were up against now Dateline, all these shows, all these network shows, Oprah and Geraldo were there personally trying to get people to talk to them. So now we're out there, like, you're also fighting for stories. Like, you're fighting to get the interview, the people to come to your show and not to go to that show. That was, you know, kind of fascinating because it was just me and him. Like, we're two little grassroots. There's a really funny story that happened with that all my friends from that show, they'll never let me live it down. But I don't know if you'd want it on here, but I could tell you, and you
course.
Could decide if you... Okay.
No, everything I'm keeping so far. Go ahead.
Okay, so basically, we're out there, and it's me and a PA, right? And we're trying to get people to talk to us. But, you know, this is like, it's real life. I mean, this isn't like covering the Olympics, right? You know, these people just lost people. Literally, we were on the plane and the girl was crying right next to us as we were sitting with our notebook, sort of trying to strategize, okay, we'll go to the Red Cross, we'll go here, where are we going to go, how are we going to track down people? Because we don't know Oklahoma City. We noticed that this girl's crying like somebody in her 20s. So we just stopped talking about it because you're like realizing, I'm going to cover a story. This poor woman
It's real.
It's real. And she's lost someone, you know, and you don't know what the situation. So anyway, we get out there and we both, you know, while we want to do a really good job, we also have respect for humanity, right? Like the people have lost kids, they've lost parents, they've lost people in this building. So, you know, we strategized that we would go to the American Red Cross, which is where the victims' families were going, and we would give out our business cards and tell them we're staying at this hotel and you could reach us. And if you want to tell your story in a national show, this is the show that we're with. But we didn't want to be pushy either, like in your face, right? So that's a fine line to walk, you know. And at the same time, like Oprah herself was there and other talk show hosts were there trying to get people, you know, to come on their show. So it's kind of hard to compete because we're just like two
You're
idiots.
Competing. Yeah. It's amazing. We're competing for a tragedy.
And that's what we do.
You have to tell the news.
Right. But, you know, we tried to do it in a very compassionate way,
of
he
course.
And I. And, you know, we made this agreement. Like, we're not going to, because some people, you know, will play dirty, right?
Sure.
Whatever, you know. So...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there were people who were actually like, there were people affiliated with certain shows who were pretending that they were victim family members and going into the meetings themselves, pretending they're a victim family member. And I was saying, you know, at what point when they reveal, like, actually, I want you to come on my show, is the person really going to want to go be on their show when they know, like, what a scumbag move you just did that?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we found what we thought were good stories. And one guy had lost two children. This African-American man, his name was Keith Coverdale, and he had lost two children in the preschool. Like, how much sadder of a story could you get?
Doesn't get much sadder than that.
They're like 3 and 4. The one I remember, one's name was Elijah, and I forget the other one's name, but I think it might have been Isaac. But anyway, it was so sad to us, you know, and so he needed a lot of hand-holding. He was like, his apartment was across the street from the federal building, and so he couldn't get in. So he said if he was going to fly to New York to do the show, he needed a suit. He needed clothes. He needed a toothbrush. He needed a funeral suit. He needed, because we also had to help make arrangements to bury these kids. I mean, that's how involved. Now, that's where I say, like, at network news, that would not happen, where you'd be, like, getting that, you know what I mean? But this was, like, syndicated talk show, and you kind of have to do what you have to do to help make it happen. You know what I mean?
Understood.
So we're helping.
And there are certain budgets, I would assume, that could go into the... Right.
Right. And we're helping. We're making phone calls for him to family members. I'm feeling terrible for this guy. I'm sticking up for him. Even my executive producer was kind of saying to me, he's asking for a lot of stuff. Like, I think he's playing you, you know?
Right. Thinking, like, it's horrible. Like, he's playing you in a death, right?
Yeah. He lost these two kids, you know? How could you, like, you know, in my mind, it's like, you know, this is real. It's not... Anyway.
Okay.
So,
God.
Boy, was my face red. Okay. So literally what happens is we drive him to the airport and he's never flown before. He was a truck driver. He'd never, maybe I shouldn't have said his name because I'm going to tell this real story. I don't know. Maybe you don't want to pay his name because I don't want you to get in trouble. But he's a truck driver and drive him to the airport, and he looks at me when I'm driving. We drive him to the airport to drop him off because we had several people. We were flying to New York, and then we're going to have our production assistants meet them at the New York airport and then take care of them. You know, they check them into their hotel and make sure that everything's good and get them to the show tomorrow. You know, it was like many people involved in the chain.
Right.
So I go to drop him off at the airport, and I was 25 years old. I'd never had anybody cross a line of inappropriateness like this, and this is a news story and a tragic one. He looks at me and he goes, do you know why I decided to do your show and not Oprah and not Geraldo, and they all asked me? And I'm like, no, you know, but I was thinking, oh, because we're so sincere and we're being so compassionate. He goes, it's because you have the most knock-em-dead titties. And we're sitting in the car at the airport.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And then, I don't know how much I can say.
Hilarious and wrong.
Hilarious. And so, but like, oh, my God. And he's like, and he asked me to do something. I just almost feel like I can't.
Yeah.
Sexual. As I'm dropping him off at the Oklahoma City airport, like before he goes, because he's nervous because he's never flown before, could I help him out a little bit, you know, like down below?
Well, you know, tragedy brings about.
And I'm like.
Brings a lot of crazy behavior.
As I said to you before, you know, about being idealistic.
Yeah.
Thinking like you're helping someone.
Sure.
And then you're like, oh, my God. And I mean, and that's where like it's funny because comedy, it does play into even, you have to have a sense of humor working in any of this stuff because I guess just life, you have to have a sense of humor.
Well, yeah,
right?
I mean, because you can't believe, this is the thing about life. I can't believe.
other, I mean, people that work with me on that show. And that's the thing, right? Things happen that you go, I couldn't even write this shit. If I wrote this, no one would believe it.
Right.
So I say, okay, well, we're going to focus. That's not happening. Let's focus. You're going to go to gate, and you're going to go here. And when you get to New York, Susan's going to meet you, and she's a PA. And he's asking me now, he's like downgrading the sexual requests to like lesser sexual. Could I at least get a hand job? You know, and I'm like, okay, that's not happening. Right. This is a, you're going to be on a TV show. Let's focus and trying to like change the subject.
Like a child. Let's focus on the tragedy.
That's what I do as, you know, as a producer. Like, okay, well, let's focus on why we're here. But so anyway, I get him to go, and then I call my PA, and I'm like, you're not going to believe this. Because here, you know, we were calling people for him. We were making sure he had underwear, toothpaste. Like, we did feel kind of taken.
Yeah.
Even though the story had really happened. Oh, I forgot to tell.
I'm telling you, the tragedy made him act nuts.
Oh, no, it wasn't the tragedy. I forgot to say this. Okay. I said to him, like, you just lost two children. Like, your focus should be. And he said, well, you know, I have like 12 kids. He's like, I have.
Oh, so, you know.
So it was like, oh, I mean.
Well, I don't care that we said his name. How about that?
And we didn't know he had 12 other kids either, that it was so inconsequential.
Yeah, that's dad.
So that was it. So we told, we gave a heads up to our PA in New York, like, be careful, because this guy may just decide to hit on you. And sure enough, he did. And down the line, hit on every woman on the production team, you know, and then I think ultimately asked them if he could find them a hooker, you know, which is definitely not part of our job. So anyway, that's
you know what? Based on other stories I've heard, it's sad. It's funny. And that's even tame compared to some of the requests that I've heard, because, you know, through friends that I know that are like, you know, that work for certain like tabloidy things have been asked to do crazy.
Right. And now that's the thing. I never wanted to be on tabloidy kind of stuff. So yeah, after coming off of like WPIX and Dateline NBC and Today Show, I was like, you know, but anyway.
It had to be refreshing, though, to work with Keenan, though.
Yes. So Keenan, like, so my thing was, I wanted to write for late night. I wanted to produce late night because I wanted to, as you said, marry the comedy with the fact that I'm a producer. So at that time in New York, there was Conan and there was Letterman and there was The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And there weren't any female writers. I mean, you know, maybe a couple female producers, but I tried Saturday Night Live, you know, tried all these shows that, you know, I wanted to work on and couldn't get hired on any of those shows, even though I had now worked my way up to being a producer, like legitimately worked my way up to being a producer, not like some comics are comic and then they get hired on a show as a producer or a writer. I mean, I spent years working my way up the literal production ladder, right?
Sure.
So, you know, plus I was a comic. So then, Keenan was kind of an amazing thing. I was actually working for Al Franken. He was developing a show called Late Line. He and his executive producer, and it was a takeoff of Dateline, but it was funny. So it was like he was the anchor of this long, you know, news format show. And I was working with him, but the job was only until we found out if NBC was picking up the show. And they did pick it up for 13 weeks, but we didn't know, you know, beyond that. Anyway, in that time, I had heard Keenan was going to have this show, and that he had, you know, his before that he had done In Living Color, and that was so funny and so amazing. And I thought, wow, well, maybe I can move to LA and get a job on this show. And it's like, it's just like how everything else ends up being, that it's so, you feel like so lucky when it works out, because I didn't know anybody there. I didn't have any in or anything. I just called the production office and asked if I could send a resume and sent the resume. And the guy who saw my resume, Todd Yasui, had just come from The Tonight Show. He was a producer at The Tonight Show, and he was going to be a senior producer at Keenan. And he, you know, saw that I was doing comedy, and then I was also, and now I was working for Al at that point, but that I'd produced all these shows. So he thought, yeah, like she would, you know, like have the background to maybe be a producer here. So a funny story about that, though, is that I had to go on the weekend, because my job was Monday through Friday with Al. I had to go on the weekend to interview with Todd. Todd's assistant told me, you're meeting at the Hollywood, I think it was called the Hollywood Coffee Shop or the Hollywood Coffee. So Todd picked the place and he said, my assistant will give you the address. Well, the assistant gave me the wrong address, or the wrong name, because the place had like, there was like, let's say Hollywood Coffee Shop and Hollywood Coffee Cafe, something like that.
The assistant gave you the wrong address.
Right, exactly. So I fly out to LA, you know, on my own dime, right, on a Saturday, basically get to the wrong place. And I realize it's the wrong place because it's like the lobby of a building. And I'm like, oh my God, this is not the right. And it's a weekend and I can't get in touch with these people because I don't know them and their offices. So I leave messages at their offices. Nobody responded, whatever. I was staying over a girlfriend's house that night, Meg, who I had grown up with, and she lived in LA. And I tell her the story, and we look up. I go, I bet you it's this other place, because this other place was like in Los Feliz, which is a little more
You're
hip. And
doing your research.
Exactly, doing my research. So this is so crazy that I got this job, right? Because we go, she goes, we have to go there tomorrow. Like, what's the chances he's going to be there tomorrow having breakfast, like the next day? Sunday, we go there, and she sees this guy that, like, she's like, I bet that's Tanya Suey. And, like, he was looking at us. And I go, how do you, like, how would you know? And how would you, you know? She goes, I bet that's him. She's like, I'm going to go over. She goes over. Are you Tanya Suey? And he says, yeah. And she goes, my friend Barry was supposed to interview with you yesterday, but your assistant gave her the wrong address. And he was just like, oh, that was yesterday. Like, I'm not, I'm sorry.
You know? Oh, really?
Yeah, he was like, going to talk to me. Really? And I was like, felt so sad. Like, I'm like, I flew 3,000 miles out here, you know?
Right.
And I said, honestly, you know, he gave me this Hollywood cafe or whatever it is. And it's, you know, so Meg, so I go back to the table. I go, well, I guess that's not going to happen. And Meg goes, I'm going over there. And Meg, like, she ended up working in TV for a while. Like,
she works
the music
at Fox
and a bunch of stuff. No, but she went over and she goes, that's ridiculous that you won't meet with her. She goes, it's not her fault that your assistant gave the wrong address, the wrong name, the wrong place. She had nobody to call. It's the weekend. She flew out here. She's like, can't you talk to her for 10 minutes? So he talked to me, and he's actually a wonderful guy, like a very cool guy. But I could see him being like, well, why weren't you here yesterday? Like, maybe it didn't, you know?
Right.
So we had like a, you know, 10-minute, then turned into 20-minute conversation. And he was like, how quickly could you be out here? Because, you know, we're going to start taping soon. Could you be out here in 2 weeks? And I'm like, you know,
you
had
go.
To like get rid of the apartment in New York and all the furniture and all the everything. And I took a chance and went, because here I was like, finally, I'm getting hired by a late night television show in comedy, which is what I
which
wanted
what
for
wanted.
Quite some time. Now, I was like 27. Which sounds like a baby now, but at the time I felt like, oh, I've been working since I'm 18, and I felt like I'm
you,
a failure.
You,
like,
right.
I'm not.
And now you've
know,
arrived. You've arrived.
That felt like that, when you said, when did you feel like? I felt like, yay, I got a job on a late night talk show. You know what I mean? And
there
with
you
comedy
go.
And somebody amazing that I respect and who's so funny and talented and all of that.
Amazing. I say this word a lot on this show, trajectory of things that happen and how we,
but
we go
that
from
funny
place
that
to
that. Now right. That assistant became an executive producer on Rachel Ray years ago, and he's now an executive producer out in LA. He's a great guy. I'd love to work with him. He's a
well,
sweet
then
kid.
I forgive him for making
totally.
The mistake.
But he's an executive producer on shows.
In case
he's,
I need to talk
yeah,
to him.
Yeah, right. No, he's very.
You're forgiven.
He's very, you know, done a lot of stuff. I actually saw, like, he's kind of been written about because he's dating some famous chef. I don't know. So,
oh, okay.
Anyway, whatever. But it's just funny how things happen, right? Because if he had been like, no, I'm absolutely not talking to you. Or if we went back and he just wasn't there, like, what's the chance he's at the same place the next day? Right?
It's amazing. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, successful people are, a fair amount of them are creatures of habit.
That's true.
Right? So that
but,
was good.
But, you know, I feel like, and it was kind of him, and he hired me, and he didn't know me from a hole in the wall. And he had all his Tonight Show people. He had brought a lot of them over. But, you know, I really felt, I always feel incredibly grateful to anyone who hires me, especially if they don't know me, because I'm like, I shouldn't say I'm like, but you know,
well, no, well, you talk,
that they're
you,
having faith in you and they're taking a chance on you.
Well, that's the this is the beauty of you that I have come to know, because you're a very, you're really warm, which is amazing that you know, you worked in news for all those years.
That's
you're really
nice
like
to
a compassionate, no, that's, you should have those qualities. Those are qualities you should have. But you talk about like, fears and insecurities mm-hmm. and you know, a procrastination you've discussed. I mean, even in this very sweet, simple blog posting.
Did
that
I write about
found,
that? It's a few years ago,
right?
But I'm sure
it is. But you talk about that, and so you know, you're a. I want to get to this other aspect here. You are this, you know, accomplished in many ways. Stand up. You're you marry, and you're a mother of two.
Yeah, two boys.
Two boys. It's a lot of work, and to stay relevant and involved and consistent. What's when do you meet your husband and the kids, and how did that factor? And because you went on to do, like, even after Keenan, you went on to
John Sally.
You went on to name just ramble them all.
Yeah, I did like a show with John Sally out there, who was great. I loved working with him. A couple weeks on Magic Johnson show, which was a short-lived show, Fox Family Channel, a couple of game shows, things like that out in LA. But at that time, then I also was you know, when I was picking the comics for Keenan, I wasn't doing stand-up because I felt like that would be like a conflict of interest.
Right, which is how I feel sometimes as a manager, but
I'm
also
sure.
as a comic. Yes,
right,
but
nowadays
totally
I think it's less of that. But I felt it then. So, but once the show was canceled, then I was doing the clubs out there. And you know how you've probably heard from a million people, you have to work your way all the way over again. That's why I say you feel like you're always starting
yeah,
over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because the fact that you worked at all these clubs in New York really didn't matter. You had to go to L.A. and keep, you know, trying to get on with the Improv and the Comedy Store and all that. And when you said, how did I meet my husband? It's kind of funny because I used to say to friends of mine, you know, with normal jobs like that aren't in the entertainment industry, and they were all getting married, you know, and having, I'd go to all these weddings and I'd be like, I'm never going to meet anybody, you know, because I'm like, who am I going to meet? Like
in this
lifestyle, right, I meet either crazy people, right, that I don't need to take on, like they're crazy with my own mishigas, right?
My favorite word.
And then, or you meet, you meet really angry, you meet really bitter, you meet really delusional, right? You meet very depressive, you meet, and you meet a lot of gay men who I love. That's like made one of my favorite, you know, sometimes I think like I think everyone should really just marry their gay best friend, but that's another story. But I was in daytime TV production, you know, it's a lot of gay men. So, who I adore, but I was like, how am I going to meet someone that I would get married to, you know? Anyway, and then how I met my husband is that I was auditioning for Mitzi Shore at the Comedy Store. Well, I did the LA audition, and then she makes you go down to La Jolla and audition at the La Jolla location. So I go down there and I meet this, the other female comic that was auditioning. Her name's Sean Pilofsky, and she was very funny, and she was Jewish from Oklahoma City, and her act was sort of about that, like being the only Jew in Oklahoma City. And
that's got to be tough.
Exactly. and I thought she was great. And after the show, I don't even remember the guys that auditioned, but after the show, I went over to her and I was like, I loved your act, and that was great, and da da da. Introduced myself to her. Well, she and I became good friends, and her sister was marrying my husband's brother. So basically, they introduced us. So I laugh because I used to say, like, I'll never meet anyone through TV and through comedy, but really, it was through comedy. Now, Sean is still a very big headliner. She headlines the Comedy Store all the time out in LA, and she travels, and she's a big, I'm giving a little shout out to Sean. She's a big gay entertainer. Like she's not gay, but she entertains like on the Atlantis cruise lines for all the gay men. Yeah, she has a huge gay following.
That's awesome.
And she's amazing.
What's her full name again?
Sean Pilofsky.
Okay, Sean Pilofsky.
She's Marla knows her really well.
Great.
Yeah. She's a great, hilarious comic, and she introduced me to him, and otherwise I would have never met him. I mean, our paths would never cross.
Married with kids.
Yeah, married with kids. And that slows things down, you know, because, I mean, I guess it doesn't have to. I look at some other women that are married
with
kids.
You got to get higher people, and they have to raise them.
Yeah, that's the
and
problem.
Right, and you can't do it because you can't have it all.
That's kind of the problem because I've had years where I had some help, like au pairs.
Sure.
And then I could still come and produce TV shows in the city. And I would do that again. There's a show I'd love to get on, I won't say, but it's coming down the pike, but that I would
we'll be
hire away and at the same time you're like, they're kids and like they deserve to have a parent around, right? So
absolutely. And so you gotta suck it up sometimes and just be responsible.
Yeah. That's funny that you said about being responsible, because I gotta say, like, you know, like this life, it's so easy to,
well, you came in here and you said that you came in about being responsible, like, didn't you say that?
I don't think I did.
Okay, no,
but
go
I just
ahead.
Think that's a funny concept about like the comic life alone, like take away the production part of it.
Yeah
you have to be responsible, you have to show up on time for shows, and if you're on the road you have to get there. But there is an element to it, right, where we can all agree that you can also be a little bit of a goof off if that was all you're doing. If you weren't writing on TV shows and having deadlines, like you can, you know, work 3 hours a day and the, you know, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, people sleep and they do a lot of this and that and whatever. So the whole being a parent,
like, it's a whole other.
Yeah, it took me to this other level of like, holy shit! It wasn't until my second kid was two that I was like, wait, I'm responsible for three meals a day. Like,
I know.
I can't even imagine.
I have such food issues.
I can't even get one meal together, and now like this is my job, you know. But
God bless you. A couple things I want to wrap up.
Yeah,
we only have a few more.
Yeah,
I mean, I can't.
Oh, sorry,
I feel
bad.
No, you know what? No, you're gonna come back.
I am.
You will come back.
Did I tell you anything funny? I don't know.
First of all, it's fascinating. I don't even give it. Yeah. we are funny, but it's fascinating. I think people need to hear, you know, more women talk about their experiences in these things. A couple things before you go. You're a savvy shopper. I know this is crazy. You're a savvy shopper.
You think?
Well, you say it yourself.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, because that was for like this local thing.
Right.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I guess I've become that.
She's become a savvy shopper.
Oh, that's funny that I even put that in there. Yeah. Because it was for a local, it was a blog for like a local thing in my town.
That's not really what I wanted to ask.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. So it was like, even though I like deep things and I like to talk about like, you know, gun violence and preventing suicide, I also get a kick out of the latest, you know, fineries at the Goofy store, right?
Yeah.
That's what that was about.
And Jim brought me a pair of dollar glasses, which I like.
They're
1.75s. Thank you. My real question is, is there anything, well, there's two questions.
Okay.
Is there anything that you would have done differently?
So many things. I can't even. I think...
Like if you had to choose a direction.
Right. I never could fully commit. I will say this. I never felt comfortable just fully committing to like, I'm just going to be a stand-up because I don't like have the trust fund and I don't have, you know, parents that are going to pay for my life.
Shaky freaking career.
Right. And I was like, I need to make money. And so, and, you know, some people waitress as their day job, but like I did go to school for broadcast journalism, political science. So for me, it was like, well, I always felt like I'm going to work.
At least you know? You're in the, you know, in the medium of.
Right. But then when I'm not hired, I'm not on a show or I'm not working, I kind of feel like a little lost. Like, well, what am I doing? Like you had said that before. What are you doing? Like, I'm not sure what I'm doing. Like, I'm trying to write a play now. I want to start a podcast, actually, that hopefully then you'll come on. But I want to start a podcast. There's some different creative things I want to do, like you said, that can go around the kids' times. There's one or two TV shows that I would love to work on that are based here in New York that if I could, I would.
Right.
Even there's a couple in L.A. that I would, you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's just getting the job.
Listen, you're getting, you know, we're talking and you know, it's getting, just staying part of the conversation, like you said, staying involved, staying in part of the conversation, getting out there. That's what we do. That's what we do here. No matter what.
Right.
Show up no matter what. Just do it no matter what.
Right. But when you say, what would I do differently? I mean, there are times that I think, I don't really wish I was this, but you see people that get ahead because they befriend certain people that take them along, or even, you know, you see the other.
You'd be surprised what people think, you know, can happen with a little bit of juice.
I'm sure. Or yeah. You see the people who, you know, the girls who like focused in on men actually helping them. Like I always say, I slept with men that couldn't help me because I had like too much pride.
Story of my life.
Yeah. So I was like, I had too much pride. My attitude was like, I'm only going to be with people who can do absolutely nothing for me so that no one can ever say, it could never be said.
Look at her. She's a doodler. What are you doodling over there? Is that Donald Trump's hair?
It looks like it. But anyway, so I don't know. And then like you look back and you go, well, you had sex with some lousy people to have sex with and they had some that, but they have this huge career. So you're like, maybe that was the way to go. You know, I don't know. I could never be that person because I don't even know how you even do that. Like you're dating them and then you go, can you put me on your network? Can you give me a television show? Like,
I don't know how
exactly
you do it,
work?
But people do it. People do it all the time.
That's what they should be writing books on, not the other. I would like them to write a book on certain people who know how to do that, how they did that, because that would fascinate me.
Listen, I never slept my way to the top. That's all I can tell you. I'm sleeping my way to the red room.
Yeah,
it's comfy. All right.
I
so,
like the red room.
Who did you really enjoy or not enjoy working with? You don't have to name names, but like, were there certain projects you were like, I can't believe I have to work with this person? This is just horrible.
I'm never really like that because I kind of can always find something, you know, like to learn about people. And I've had some really hard bosses, but I think sometimes the hardest ones are the most brilliant. So when they're really like smart and brilliant, I'm able to take the like erratic, crazy behavior. But when they're not. And they have those kind of behaviors that you're just like, really? I mean, you know what I mean?
Right.
But I mean, because Keenan can be a difficult, you know, he's not an easy person, but he like, I thought he was brilliant. I thought his, you know, comedy was brilliant. His sharp decision making, you know, so.
Absolutely.
And I worked with some people in news that were pretty tough, but like tough and you respected their work, you know?
Yeah.
It's harder to do it when you don't respect the work.
Well, I can see now, having spent this much time with you, because we've seen each other peripherally, you know, through the shows at Broadly Funny that you've been on with at Broadway Comedy Club and throughout and other meetings where we've seen each other. I can see the comic in you and the newswoman in you.
Oh, really?
Thanks. And like she's like, you could see her, just the mind is constantly working and racing, and it's been a lot of fun.
I wish the mind wasn't always racing, Gina.
You know, that's why you take a moment. You know, I was talking to somebody earlier, that the only discourse that we have these days, at least, is through podcasts. Like, a lot of people don't take the time to just sit
or talk.
I mean, when you interview everyone is a subject.
Right.
We're a subject. You're my friend. Yeah. You're also right now you're my subject, but you're my friend.
Yes.
But you're truly my, you know, I'm not just randomly picking people, but there's a lot of that going on. So I really wish people were talking to each other more.
Just in life,
at.
You mean?
Yeah.
Right. Instead of just hitting like.
Like. By the way, Jim got us a selfie stick. We're going to practice with.
Oh, that's awesome.
Afterwards. Yeah. $298. Thanks, Jim.
Cool. Well, you're like
spender.
The queen of selfies. You should do a book.
Yeah, but I have
good,
I have a very long arm, and it's me and James Franco.
See, I think
me
you
and
should
James
do a
Franco.
Book, the Red Light Redux Boudoir Selfies. Like, you're always so hot and sexy in these.
You are what you are.
And that's right. That's right. But you could do a whole book of your, you know.
Yeah, it's a lot of smoke and mirrors, kids.
But you could show that a woman over 25 can still be.
She can be viable. I like to say
super
viable.
Hot. Yeah,
she's viable. One last thing before we close up, and you tell me what you think. We have maybe 4 minutes.
Okay,
I have a friend in comedy, Carlo Bellario. He was doing an independent film. He wasn't getting paid. It was literally pizza. It was New Jersey. He was arrested for, you know, waving around a gun in New Jersey.
Oh, wow.
And it was like a BB gun for this film. I don't know if you heard about it.
No.
But he's got GoFundMe.com/rawdeal because New Jersey wants to put him away for 10 years for being in an independent film, waving because they have heavy duty gun laws,
right.
Which I believe in. I believe we should have these laws. I believe there should be. But this guy was holding a BB gun for a film. Let's try to put the, you know, the rationale there together.
There's many other people.
There's many other people getting away with a lot more than a guy filming a scene for a movie that, you know, just to make a dollar for his family.
Absolutely.
So let's put him away for 10 years. I have nothing more to add, but I'm sure you can agree with that.
That's
injustice.
Crazy.
That's ridiculous.
That's crazy.
And
hope that the GoFundMe goes well for him.
Thank you. I think we need to fight injustice. We need to stay doing comedy, right? You're just going to get up some more?
Yeah. Yeah, got to keep getting up, right?
Got to keep getting up.
Every time you get up, then you go, why don't I get up more? This is so fun. I love it. It's the booking and the, you know,
okay,
schlepping.
I've got some dates in March coming up for Broadly.
Fun.
So
that's always a fun show. I love that show.
So check back with us. Check BroadwayComedyClub.com. You'll be able to check those shows. And then Barry Elise will be on those, and you can check those. And we just look forward to having I'm going to have you back.
Great. That would be awesome.
Can people find you on Facebook?
Yeah, they can find me there. Right now I'm in a Twitter hideout, so they can't find me there. I closed my little Twitter account, but I'm going to start another one maybe. So I don't know. I have an Instagram, Fun Barry Elise.
Fun Barry Elise?
Yeah, that's because it's only the fun side.
B-A-R-I. B-A-R-I-A-L-Y-S-E. Fun Barry Elise on Instagram. I am Gina Savage. You can find me at Savage in the City.
Thank you so much for having me, Gina.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. You can find me at Savage in the City on Twitter, Savage in the City Pics on Instagram. Thank you again, Barry, for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Very informative. Good time. We'll have you back. Thank you, WROM radio listeners in Detroit. Find us on iTunes, the Red Light Podcast Redux. And it's been great. I'm just... I'm going to just say thank you to you, Jim Verne. And we are out. Have a good one, guys. See you next week.